The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back. Today, we are diving into a huge, and I mean huge, stretch of history that most of us probably have the wrong idea about.
We're talking about the Middle Ages, that thousand-year period from roughly 500 to 1500.
Exactly. And we're going to dismantle that old, lazy label it always gets stuck with, the Dark Ages.
And that's really the core of our deep dive today. We're using the insights from historian Miri Rubin's fantastic book, The Middle Ages, a very short introduction to challenge that very idea.
Our mission here is to get past the stereotypes, you know, the knights, plagues, and this idea of a totally stagnant society.
Right, because Rubin argues this wasn't some long, boring gap between Rome and the Renaissance. This is the crucible. This is where the modern world was actually forged.
And that's why this matters to you listening right now. If you want to understand our universities, our legal systems, even how international banking got started.
You do now can't cur it. You have to go back here. This is the origin story for so many institutions we just take for granted today.
So let's talk about our guide on this journey, Miri Rubin. She's a major figure in this field.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
A professor at Queen Mary University of London, a fellow of the British Academy. She has, you know, some serious academic weight.
But what I find so compelling about her work is her approach. It's not all about kings and battles, is it?
Not at all. And that's what makes her perfect for this. She's a social historian. She's interested in the lived experience of normal people.
Like, what did people actually believe? How did communities work?
Precisely. She's written about things like religious rituals, Jewish-Christian relations. She looks at history from the ground up.
And that perspective lets her see the whole picture, not just what the elites were doing. She finds innovation in the fields and marketplaces, not just in the castles.
Which is essential for a period this long. So the book's central argument is that the Middle Ages was this powerhouse of change and complexity. It didn't just stumble on after Rome fell.
It actually absorbed what was left of Rome and built something new.
Exactly. And to make sense of it all, she doesn't just march through the centuries. The book is organized thematically.
Which is so helpful. She starts with these pillars, right? Like what was left over from Rome.
Right, the inheritance. And then she moves to what you could call the cultural operating system of the whole era, Christendom.
That's more than just religion, isn't it?
Oh, much more. It was a shared identity, a legal framework, a common language for the educated Latin. It shaped absolutely everything.
Then there's the economic engine, towns, trade.
The whole political landscape, which was messy. Power was always being negotiated.
And finally, she gets to the culture and learning, the things that directly bust the Dark Ages myth, and crucially, how medieval Europe defined itself against others.
Its relationship with the Islamic world and its treatment of internal groups like Jewish communities. It's a really complete picture.
Okay, let's start there with that name. Where did the Dark Ages even come from? Rubin points out it wasn't a term from the time itself.
Not at all. It was invented much, much later. We're talking 14th, 15th century Renaissance humanists.
So people who wanted to make their own time look good.
That's the heart of it. They looked back to ancient Greece and Rome as this golden age, and they needed to label the thousand years in between as, well, a dark, barbaric interruption.
So it's not a historical fact. It's basically just marketing.
It's intellectual PR. And Rubin's work is all about filling that supposedly empty space with a dynamic, complicated life that was actually there.
So how does she start? By tackling the fall of Rome.
Yeah, and she shows it wasn't this one single event, like a switch being flipped. It was a slow, long transformation over centuries.
The institutions didn't just vanish overnight.
No, they blended. They sort of fused with the cultures of the Germanic peoples moving in, a kind of creative synthesis. But as the central state bureaucracy withered away, there was a huge power vacuum.
And something had to step in and provide some kind of order.
And that something was the institutional Christian church. Bishops, monasteries, they were often the only organized structure left. They preserved classical learning, administration.
And the Latin language.
They became the new backbone of society, the continuity.
Okay, but if the era was so dynamic, why do we have this mental image of, you know, peasants stuck in the mud? Let's talk about the economy.
This is one of the biggest myths to bust. Rubin shows that starting around the 11th century, the economy just explodes.
And this was driven by new tech, right? An agricultural revolution.
A quiet one, but yes. It was the widespread use of the heavy plow, for one.
Which could handle the tough, dense soils of Northern Europe.
Exactly. and also the three-field crop rotation system.
Right.
A simple idea, but it massively boosted food production.
More food means more people.
And more people means you can have cities. Real bustling cities again. This is where we see guilds popping up, sophisticated groups of craftsmen, and we see the invention of financial tools.
Things we still use, like letters of credit, banking.
Venice, Genoa, Florence. These places were becoming global financial hubs. They were connected to the Byzantine Empire, the Islamic world, all the way to China along the Silk Road.
So it was both intensely local and surprisingly global at the same time.
A perfect way to put it.
So with all this new wealth in these growing cities, how did that change politics? Power wasn't simple, was it?
Not even close. It was a constant push and pull. You had the king, you had powerful local nobles, and then you had the enormous transnational power of the Pope.
I'm thinking of things like the investiture controversy.
A perfect example. That was a huge fight over who got to appoint bishops, the king or the pope. It shows you just how limited a king's power could really be.
But let me push back a bit. For the average peasant, wasn't life still just brutal and unchanging? Is this dynamism just something the top 1% experienced?
That is such a fair and crucial question. And yes, for many, daily life was incredibly hard, but the system itself was changing under their feet. And that was driven by, of all things, war.
Because kings always need money for armies.
They always need money. And they couldn't just take it. They had to ask for it. They had to get the consent of the realm.
So they called assemblies.
They did. Assemblies of nobles, clergy, and more, representatives from those rich new towns. And right there.
That's the beginning of Parliament.
That's the seed. The English Parliament, the French Estates General, that principle that a ruler needs consent for taxation, is a core medieval invention.
Which brings us right to the biggest myth of all, that this was a time of intellectual darkness.
The exact opposite is true. I mean, first, you have the birth of the university.
Yeah.
An entirely new kind of institution.
Bologna, Paris, Oxford.
Right. And these weren't just random collections of scholars. They were organized corporations for teaching and research in law, medicine, theology.
And inside these universities, you get this method called scholasticism.
Which sounds heavy. But the basic idea was to use rigorous logic, Aristotle's logic, which had been preserved and commented on by Arabic scholars, to explore and understand Christian doctrine.
So it was an effort to prove faith and reason could work together.
A massive, intense intellectual project. And you could see this intellectual energy visually. Just look at the Gothic cathedrals.
Soaring architecture, stained glass, their feats of engineering and mathematics.
They are theological arguments made of stone and light. You just can't call an era that produced them dark.
There was darkness, wasn't there? The book doesn't ignore the intolerance.
No, and it's vital not to. Rubin shows how medieval Christendom really defined itself by identifying who was not part of it.
The other.
The other. There was the external other. Primarily the Muslim world, which they met in the Crusades, but also traded with. And then there was the internal other.
Jewish communities.
Yes. They were often restricted, legally and socially, and tragically became easy scapegoats in times of crisis, like during the plagues.
And this also applied to Christians who didn't follow the official line, right? Heretics.
Like the Cathars, who were brutally suppressed. So this incredible piety and intellectual genius existed right alongside deep paranoia and cruelty. It's a contradiction we have to hold in our minds.
Okay, let's zoom out. What are the big takeaways Rubin wants us to leave with?
I think the first theme is clear. We have to kill the myth of medieval stagnation. This period was buzzing with change.
And that makes you think, what modern, simple narratives do we just accept without questioning the nuance?
Absolutely. The second big theme is the centrality of Christendom. It was the software running the whole society.
Which makes you ask, what are the powerful shared ideologies that act as our operating system today? Is it a political belief? A global economic model?
A great question. A third theme is that interplay of the local and the global. Life on the manor was small, but you were connected through the church or trade routes to a huge world.
We feel that tension today, don't we? Between our local communities and these massive global forces.
We really do. And finally, there's a theme of resilience in crisis. The Black Death was an unimaginable catastrophe, killing maybe half the population.
You'd think that would be the end.
But instead, by making labor suddenly scarce and valuable, it completely upended the old social and economic order. It shows how crisis can force the most radical and necessary innovations.
Let's pull out a few core ideas from the book that really stick with you.
Okay. Here's one that basically summarizes the whole mission of the book.
Yeah.
The idea is that the Middle Ages was a term invented to create distance and assert superiority. we discover not a void, but the very crucible in which the foundations of the modern West were forged.
It's about reclaiming its importance. I like that.
Then there's one that captures the energy of the time. The medieval world, far from being static, was in constant motion driven by the blades of new plows, the bustling ambition of merchants, the fervent arguments of scholars.
It's an image of action, of striving, not stagnation.
And one more on the cities. The medieval city was Europe's greatest invention, creating new forms of freedom, prosperity, and cultural expression.
So how can we apply all this? How does knowing this change things for us?
Well, the most direct way is in understanding our institutional roots. When you hear a debate about university reform or how Parliament works,
you can remember that these things weren't created perfectly. They grew out of messy medieval problems, usually about money and power.
Right. It also helps us develop a critical perspective. The book is a masterclass in not accepting lazy labels. We can use that skill everywhere, in politics, in the news. Always look for the complexity behind the headline.
And there's a more somber lesson, too.
There is. The history of how Jewish communities and heretics were treated, especially in times of crisis. It's a timeless warning about the dangers of scapegoating.
Using an other to unite the in-group is a pattern that repeats itself. Understanding it historically helps us see it more clearly today.
It does.
You know, the thing that really surprised me was this idea that globalization isn't new. We think it's a modern thing. But a world connected by Latin and the Silk Road, that was already a kind of global system.
It absolutely was. And for me, the final takeaway is just that history is messy. The Middle Ages contained both genius and cruelty, breathtaking progress, and terrible regression. It's not a simple story, and that's why it's so important to study it seriously. It truly set the stage for everything that came next. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.